Welcome to Faith Biscuits. Today, a book becomes a movie used in a TV show, conspiring together to teach a lesson on loving and accepting what is, even in the face of what could have been. This episode is called The Remains of the Career. Chapter 1, The Book. The Remains of the Day by Kazuo Ishiguro won the prestigious Man Booker Prize in 1989. I think it was that gold-looking sticker that probably drew my attention as it sat on a mostly abandoned shelf in the lobby by the elevator at my dad's retirement community building. I picked it up and remembered I wanted to read this, so I took it. The little gold award sticker helped it move more quickly up through my stack back at home. Whoever said, "Never judge a book by its cover," obviously had too few choices to make. I always judge a book by its cover. How else are you going to evaluate a book you haven't read? This one had not only the title I recalled after all these months and years, but also had an award, a gold star. The Remains of the Day is historical fiction. It's a story about a butler, Stevens, who is keeping an English estate in working order in the 1950s, following the death of the Lord, Darlington by name. And much is told in flashback, which creates a certain emotional reserve throughout the book, not typically in my cup of carefully poured tea, so to speak, but well suited to the detailed and proper European world we get invited into. Stevens, we never even learn this stoic man's first name, has just received a letter from a Miss Kenton. She used to work on the estate with him in the telling years leading up to World War II, the dramatic gatherings of important men at the estate with the late Darlington were well catered to by Stevens and Miss Kenton and the rest of the staff. The rising of Nazi Germany was the backdrop for their own growing acquaintance. Beneath the growing cloud of war, they got to know each other as well as a very proper butler and his service staff might get to know one another. So wartime, almost romance. Fifteen years later, in the 1950s, Stevens is driving in a borrowed car to tour the countryside and will be in her town. A letter Miss Kenton has just sent him all these years later has made him suspect she is close to divorce. She might be reaching out to him, remembering their previous close working relationship. She might also be looking for something more. You see, he blew it 15 years ago and sort of knows it. She was interested in him, but he was too proper to respond. He was too committed to perfect service under the late Lord Darlington. But now there is a new lord of the manor, less sophisticated, an American actually. There doesn't seem to be the same need to protect a reputation, is what is suggested. And in remembering some of the conversations from much earlier during the months leading to war, Stevens sees Darlington himself in a compromised light. He may have actually been a Nazi sympathizer. Was that a kind of honor even worth preserving? Had Stevens been too careful in maintaining and serving the status quo? In so doing, did he overlook and miss a personal opportunity? There's a great scene in an English pub where Stevens has stopped for afternoon tea. Remembering the war and all that it entailed, the stories of the locals take on a tender significance. In that dark wooden interior with new intimacies among strangers, what struck me about The Remains of the Day, everyone just assumed the war was going on, would go on, and the outcome was obviously determined far and away elsewhere. There is a fatalism that cloaks World War II romances. Two, as a result, everybody's life took on a smaller, humbler mean. Shopkeepers would keep on, spouses too. We were living through the war together. What was your particular life like during the war? Shaped everything they recalled now. It was a given. Compromises, adjustments, these things were universal. Everybody was made a bit smaller in their lives by having their own story suddenly become secondary for those years. Nobody was expected to be either particularly profound about it, life is what it is, nor was anybody remotely expected to do anything about it. You needn't have a lot of political insight into it. That was rendered almost irrelevant. Your young man had gone to serve, but for the rest of us, just riding this thing out was the prime raison d'etre, our only needed reason for being. I don't know anything about author Ishiguro or how a Japanese author wins a Booker Prize, but maybe he knows something about the outsized scale of war and how it colors all stories beneath it. All other stories are excused for suddenly being smaller, especially romance, or maybe especially unrequited love and not quite romance. Chapter 2. The Scene. Then there is one other memorable flashback scene in the remains of the day as I read it in the evenings in bed. A scene where Stevens has retired to his study. He is reading and says, "Come in," before realizing who it might be. And it is Miss Kenton, suddenly intimate and before him in these tumultuous pre-war days. There is a familiarity in the scene between these two workers, but the intimacy of Stephen's chamber highlights both their own familiarity of one another as well as the daring immediacy of the fluid boundaries. During the day, these keep them safely defined by role, butler, staff member. Here in his bedchamber, the rules are different, and the two feel suddenly equals, dangerously. Miss Kenton asks, "What are you reading?" It's both an utterly natural but also terribly personal question. What are you reading? "Just a book," comes the utterly unhelpful, shy, even evasive reply. This interaction is already more personal than their work relationship allows for, really. "Is it a romance? Is it racy?" Miss Kenton asks, and the very question feels almost obscene, too personal. But responding to the feelings of threat as she approaches him, Stevens almost pushes her away and she is forced to retreat, physically and emotionally. But what you also get from that scene is a sense of regret. Should she push in further? Intimacy like that in an American story would have certainly led to a sex scene, but here, the reach for closeness is unrequited. Is it because it's British? Japanese? That kind of reserve is their territory, not ours. "Let me see the book," she quietly, vulnerably asks. And I want so bad for Stevens to let his guard down. Show her the book. That's when I remembered the movie. I suddenly saw Anthony Hopkins in my mind's eye, pulling a book back towards himself and playfully but sternfully trying to avoid the prying attentions of... I pulled out my phone, went to IMDb, the Internet Movie Database, the solution for all such queries. Emma Thompson playing Miss Kenton. She was the almost love interest, but an interest so fabulously understated and reserved as to be a marvel to watch. I had seen the movie 25 years ago and not thought of it since.
"You're reading?"
"Yeah."
"Very dim in here. Can you see?"
"Yes, thank you."
"What are you reading?"
"A book."
"Yes, what sort of book?"
"It's a book, Miss Kenton. Book."
"What's the book? Are you shy about your book?"
"No."
"Is it? Is it racy?"
"Racy?
Are you reading a racy book?"
"Do you think racy books are to be found in his lordship's shelves?"
"How would I know? What is it? Let me see it. Let me see your book."
"Please leave me alone, Miss Kenton."
"Why won't you show me your book?"
This is my private time. You're invading it.
Oh, is that so?
Yes.
I'm invading your private time, am I?
Yes.
What's in that book? Come on, let me see. Or are you protecting me? Is that what you're doing? Would I be shocked? Would it ruin my character? Let me see it.
Not to disturb the few moments I have to myself.
The movie earned 8 Oscar nominations. It lost Best Picture to Schindler's List, lost Best Director to Steven Spielberg for Schindler's List, Best Music and Original Score lost to John Williams, also of Schindler's List. Really a pretty understandable collection to lose out to. Emma Thompson lost Best Actress to Holly Hunter in The Piano in that year, also another understated and haunting film. And Anthony Hopkins lost Best Actor to Tom Hanks in Philadelphia. Hard to feel too bad about that competition, nor is it. To be nominated for all the important categories and still lose. Alas! And all that reserve and unrequited love, that intense and sad longing unfulfilled beneath the dark sky of a world war nobody could do anything about, other than to try to live through. Chapter 3, The Sopranos. When my wife goes away for a few days at a time, I can binge watch things on Netflix that she isn't interested in. The Wire and The Sopranos are two shows that always come up among the handful of greatest series to ever grace a screen. Breaking Bad is the other, rightfully so. We both loved it. As a matter of fact, our TV watching, almost exclusively reserved now for Netflix, has dropped by 90% in the last year or so. We are frankly still in grief about missing Breaking Bad and lacking any replacement. I have yet to sell her on either The Wire or The Sopranos, so when I get the chance, her being gone, I binge. She was gone for 10 days this past August, and so at dinner I would sit down in front of the TV and I started through season 1 of The Sopranos. I had finished Ishiguro's Remains of the Day that week and was starting into a mediocre book on record collecting. But a few episodes into The Sopranos, episode 5, Tony is taking his daughter on a college tour to choose a school. There are a number of just brilliant scenes where she is suspecting his job might be something other than what he is letting on. There is suspense, there's a killing, great stuff, great acting, great writing. Meanwhile, his wife Carmela is back at home with the flu. On a terrible rainy night, the doorbell rings and it is their priest, a young, handsome Father Phil. Don't worry, listeners, this is really going somewhere. Now, Carmela is not happy in her marriage. She has just found out that Tony is seeing a female therapist, and she is jealous in the face of his ongoing secrecy professionally as well. She's suddenly vulnerable to the intimate connection she has already with Father Phil. She makes him baked ziti, and he has too much wine while they sit to visit and eat. She doesn't think he should be out in the rain, so they share details of their struggling lives instead. She and her priest almost kiss. It is very suspenseful. As a way of both naming and backing out of their intimacy, she instead puts on a movie. She puts on The Remains of the Day, and they are showing that scene where Emma Thompson, as Miss Kenton, presses into Anthony Hopkins, Mr. Stevens, room and wants to know what he is reading.
What are you reading?
A book.
It's what sort of book?
It's a book, Miss Kenton. A book.
What's the book?
To review, a book is published to acclaim in 1989 about events in the 1950s recalling history from the late 1930s pre-World War. A movie is made from that book, also released to acclaim, although no awards, in 1993. That movie is later used as a background, ambiance, emotional tone setter in an HBO show in 1999. That book gets read by me in 2018, the same summer I start watching The Sopranos from 1999 that uses a single scene from the movie I remember seeing 25 years earlier. It's a good scene. You can find it on YouTube. All I want to talk about in closing is the poignancy of unrequited love in a time of war. These are the two greatest themes in all of literature, so nothing terribly uncommon there, but how they came together in a multitude of ways and my own coincidental or God-given and given to me to interpret manner. I don't know any pastor for whom grief isn't an almost unbearable experience in their professional life daily. The demise of institutional religion in the last 30 years in our culture is a nagging and sad distraction for many believers. It is an absolutely shocking world changer for those of us on the inside. But nobody blame themselves for the war. Historical romances set in wartime have this fatalism and epic sense of history. Our love story is but a small scene amidst a far more vast landscape. Our stories are as important as ever, but put into a different perspective. Nobody's going to ask how minding the store helped the Germans or Allies, but they might well ask, what was your life like during the war, minding that store? Don't get me wrong. I'm not suggesting there is a war on religion or the church, or that people like me who get paid to essentially talk with people, read, write, and now do podcasts are somehow put upon or need pity. I am suggesting that the romance many, many of us signed on to a career ago has not turned out even remotely the way we expected or the way we wanted. For some of the most gifted and faithful people I have ever met, it has been a number of decades of unrequited love and regret, wishing for things that never happened and wondering what we did wrong, how things could have gone better, and being utterly powerless to change the flow of history. What could we have done differently? Not a thing. The war is both a long ways away and right here, far deeper and more unimaginably vast than any one of the thousands of congregations who have their own survival stories to share. We are actors on a stage which is far broader than we can even fathom. Epilogue. Eugene Peterson, beloved Christian author and theologian, hero more to the pastors I know than the congregants, died this week, age 85. He wrote a book almost 40 years ago called A Long Obedience in the Same Direction. In it, he says, I open myself to the frustrations and failures of loving, daring to believe that failing in love is better than succeeding in pride. In the remains of the day, there is a closing scene at a bus stop where Stevens is dropping Miss Kenton. She is going back to her husband after all. Stevens mistook her intent in writing initially. This is merely a nostalgic check-in with a work associate. He really did miss his chance with her 20 years ago. And now what is left is sadness, regret, but also an honoring of history, of what did actually play out, what is. Serving well, even under a lord he wishes were different, he will return and get back to work with his romantic fantasy still unfulfilled. his reserve that made him miss an opportunity years ago, is now what is holding him and this beautifully poignant, permanent farewell scene together. The past and all that has happened and failed to happen still haunts him. Indeed, that is what the entire book is about. But what is left of his life and work is coming still. Duty and living call. This is what remains of the day he and we are given. And there's still work to be done.